thank you for that warm welcome on a cold night here in Des Moines, Iowa. And actually, it's been very cold, but you've been very warm to me. And this church in particular, I really am grateful for. We have an important message to share tonight, probably more important than any movie like Pastor Ellis said you could be at tonight. I want to thank Chris for inviting me and the entire staff, Pastor Phil and everyone here. Chris has read my book. Of course, he did challenge me to come and present my material. And that was before Christmas, and I didn't know how to do PowerPoint. So I'm going to admit that to you tonight. But you'll see I'm a quick learner. 250 frames to convince you in 100 minutes what's going on in our country, okay? This is my first opportunity to really share with you the whole story of my book. Not just in bits and parts, because you know how radio is. Commercials and conversations and so on. So tonight is an opportunity to really do that. And we're going to be talking about politics, economics, and religion, and how these all tie in together. These are my favorite subjects, by the way. So whenever I'm in a mixed company, I have trouble sometimes connecting with people. But I do want to warn you that once you learn these truths, you really can't unlearn them, right? Once you learn something, you just can't unlearn it. So you're going to be learning some things tonight, and so I really want to move quickly. And, of course, the Bible says the truth would set you free. So let's get started tonight. And, of course, this opening quote is by Adam Smith about nations go bankrupt when they get to be too far in debt, which, of course, is what we are in. The reasons I wrote the book are as follows. We have twin deficits. We have unfunded liabilities for Social Security and Medicare. We also have global credit derivatives, which are staggering. We're going to look at these tonight. We're also going to look at geopolitical tensions, which are rising in the world, in addition to a potential currency collapse, which is a theme of my book as well. We also are going to look for the need to people to wake up. Very frustrating to share these things with people, new clients and friends, and inform them what's going on. And finally, we're going to look at how this fits into a prophetic matrix for the end times, the future of America, and so on. And, of course, this ties into the Left Behind series. How many people have actually looked at this series? Okay, very popular. 80 million copies have been sold around the country and around the world. And so we're going to look at that theme. Also, it's my company, IDP Consulting Group, and we have some tables back here for you. We're going to provide some information on gold and silver portfolios, some precious metals IRA accounts that you can consider, tangible assets. We also have cash accounts to consider, as well as foreign currencies, commodity funds, and, of course, the energy sector, global investments, and this area of contingency planning. So we're going to provide some information there. And, of course, you've had a stewardship focus here at Grace Church for about a month, and I think this will tie in very well for you. So tonight's schedule, we're going to look at the we're starting pretty much on time at 7 o'clock here, and we're going to have a special drawing before we break in the middle here. And everybody got a registration card tonight. If anybody has not gotten a card, just put up your hand. Maybe one of the ushers will come up here, okay, and give you one of those. We're going to have a special drawing. This is one per household. This will include a free book, a report, CD, free consulting, and we have a special package for you back there for you. We'll be doing that, okay? And I know that the mind cannot absorb more than the seat can endure, so we will be taking a break 15 minutes, okay, down the road. And part two is going to deal primarily with political paradigms and prophetic implications. So part two will be dealing with that. So let's get started tonight. Let me ask you a question. What is money? How many would agree that this is money right here? You like that? Money in your pocket? How many agree that that is money? All right? How many agree that this is money? You're out here in the livestock. That's why they call it livestock. And, of course, even seashells. There's basically, in history, there's been four kinds of money. There's been commodity money. There's been fiduciary money. There's been fractional money. And then, finally, there's been fiat money. We need to look at these individually. The commodity money has to do with it's a coincidence of wants. In other words, money should be a store of value. I said this on the radio program this morning. So it should be something that has a store of value. It should be tangible. And this evolved over time to be the term money actually comes from the term, Latin term for moneta, meaning mint. So something had to be durable. If you wanted flour for eggs, it could spoil over time. So we evolved into fiduciary money. And this was in the Middle Ages where the goldsmiths made deposits. People had gold and silver, and they made deposits in the goldsmiths for safekeeping. And then they issued them a warehouse receipt. And so that's a receipt like paper money that they would actually give them to, it would be an instrument they could use on the street or something. And they were 100% fully backed. And that's important because that's really a fiduciary money. It means you have trust or faith in it. Then the evolution came to fractional money, where the goldsmiths became bankers and lenders. And that is a case where not everybody wanted their coins at the same time. And so they basically, the goldsmiths had them in their possession, and they held it as an asset and a liability because they only kept about 15% as reserves, and they were loaning out 85%. As long as nobody figured it out, then nobody would be any wiser. And this is kind of how banking works today, okay? Then we have the final evolution, and this is to fiat money, where we are pretty much today, where money is issued by government decree and simply has legal tender status. In other words, just because the government says it is by fiat, that is what they say. So there's no currency backing for the currency today, and no protection from monetary inflation either. In fact, two people on the House Banking Committee with Dr. Ron Paul actually thought we were still on the gold standard. They didn't even realize that we have just fiat money right now, okay? So we basically want constitutional money, and this is what our founding fathers expressly wanted. They wanted to make sure that to coin money and fix the standard of weights, and no state shall make anything but gold and silver as tender in payment. And so they knew that we needed to make sure that the money was fiduciary in the sense that it was reliable. And this was later said by Andrew Jackson in his statement that it's apparent from the context of the U.S. Constitution that it was the purpose of the convention to establish a currency consisting of the precious metals. And so that's where we are today. They didn't want paper money. And this, of course, quote and this picture on the cover of my book is from George Washington. And he said that we may one day become a great nation. But he said, if in the pursuit of the means, we should unfortunately stumble again on unfunded paper or similar species of fraud, we'll give a fatal stab to our national credit. And this is kind of where we are today in the 231 years later of our country. Thomas Jefferson then said, a famous quote by him, he said, all the perplexities, confusions, and distresses in America arise not from defects in the Constitution as much as from downright ignorance of the nature of coin and credit and how money, what money really is. And this, what we've just seen is the evolution of money and how it's progressed to something that has no backing whatsoever. So we're basically putting our currency, our nation at risk, that fatal stab that George Washington talked about. This goes back to man's very nature to want to make money out of nothing with no value and just print it. And it goes back to the Garden of Eden. And it says, Frederick Bastiat, when they can, people wish to live and prosper at the expense of others. And this desire has its origin in the very nature of man, the very nature to satisfy his desires with the least amount of possible pain. So the final evolution of money in fiat currency is bound up with people's desire to make money out of thin air. And this temptation is great. And it was actually established by the Money Trust on Wall Street. And some of you have read my book, and you know this history where this has led to on Wall Street during the Progressive Era in about 1910, around that era. And they became tremendously wealthy, and they wanted to create a cartel, a banking cartel. They created the Bank of 1907. And at that time, there was Senator Nelson Aldrich. They founded the National Monetary Committee, which was founded for the purpose of creating a central bank. This is by Senator Nelson Aldrich of Rhode Island. It was basically supplied by the Rockefeller and Morgan people. And they were trying to create in the Federal Reserve a lender of last resort as a central bank. They also spoke often about the need for an elastic currency. They didn't want to be bound by the limitation of banks and reserves, reserve requirements, things like that. So they basically wanted to create a banking cartel. This they did on Jekyll Island in November of 1910. This is a rather long story, and it goes into it in the book, how they created a secret meeting on the bankers to create a central bank. And this is where the Federal Reserve really came from. So it's not really part of the government. The Federal Reserve Act was passed in 1913, and then we had a banking cartel, which was established. So this is actually where it happened. This is Jekyll Island, owned by J.P. Morgan. In 1910, they conspired there for about 2 weeks and created the Federal Reserve System today. The Federal Reserve was built in 1914, and it was this is the building here, completed in 1924. This is actual elevators of cash in Manhattan Island, where the New York branch of the Federal Reserve is at today. It has 2,300 employees, as opposed to the other reserve banks, which have merely hundreds, if any, not that many. The first chairman was Benjamin Strong, who came over from J.P. Morgan. So a little bit of history here, and he's on the left there. He actually was presiding over the bank through the 1920s, and remember the Roaring Twenties gave rise to the Great Depression later. He died a year before that event. But that's the boom-bust cycle that central banks create in the country today. Timothy Geithner is the Federal Reserve Chairman now in New York, and an establishment figure, and that really is our central bank, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. If you go there today, you can go down to the basement, and as the 10 stories down is where they hold all the gold. Now, the gold is there. It's not there to back your currency, however. It's there just because it has been moved over from Fort Knox. It's part of the Reagan Commission report in 1982, and there's about 266 million ounces of gold. Again, this is not to back the gold. This is just where the gold has been taken for the bankers. I guess you could say the golden rule is those who own the gold make the rules. So the Federal Reserve is our fiscal agent and unfortunately is not a federal agent arm of the United States government. The Federal Reserve is not federal. If you'll notice up here, we have a Federal Reserve stamp up here, mail, but it's metered. Down here is a government stamp from the Internal Revenue Service, and it's just about like Federal Express is what the Federal Reserve is. And some of you, again, have read my book to know that. Congressman Wright Patman, a critic of the Federal Reserve, said in 1964 that basically we have two governments in America. He said basically two governments. We have duly constituted government, then we have an independent, uncontrolled, and uncoordinated government, the Federal Reserve. And you wonder, how has this happened unregulated and become what he calls a banker's club? And some have referred to it even as a syndicate. So it's basically, it's necessary to understand that the Federal Reserve, when it was created in 12 districts. 12 districts in which it kept the idea that the New York was not running it, so they had to hide that idea. And today, 38% of the banks, 5,000 commercial banks, 50 money center banks have 33% of all the checkbook money. So it's really only about 38% of the banks in America that are really part of the Federal Reserve System. And they really have an advantage in doing this because then they can borrow money from the Fed and then lend it out to you. The worst thing that could ever happen to a bank is if a bank ran out of money to lend. If you're in business for something, you want to have plenty of stock and inventory. So what a great opportunity they've had. And, of course, they like to use the idea and put their logo in the middle of the U.S. Mint and Treasury to give you the idea that it is part of the government as well. There's an excellent book written by G. Edward Griffin called The Creature from Jekyll Island. And I've used a lot of his material in my book, and I would recommend his book is very thick. It'd probably be easier to get my book and read it. So Federal Chairman Ben Bernanke, of course, is now the Fed Chair at this time. The government can print money three different ways. They can tax, or they can borrow, or they can print. Now, it's very unpopular to tax because that could cost you your career. It's not a good idea to borrow because that's a lot of debt. And then printing money is not very well understood. So that's really the easiest way for the government to finance its programs. And one of the policy tools they have, and it's a little complicated, is the Federal Open Market Committee. They meet eight times a year. And this chart is in my book to help understand this a little bit better. But this is how they actually take in U.S. securities on your behalf and your children. They take in securities from bond dealers exclusively on New York. They place these into the Federal Reserve as inventories as new debt, again, on behalf of you and your children and future generations. They do this, then they issue the currency to the New York banks. And these are special commercial banks. We're talking Goldman Sachs and the very large enterprises connected with them. And then finally, it's the final cycle is when this comes out to the commercial banks, into your banks, and new checkbook money. And this is how we proliferate the money. In fact, they call helicopter Ben, is what they call Bernanke now, going in around in a helicopter, providing liquidity in answer by just providing money. This stimulation package, which passed today, $168 billion to give tax money back, that's one thing. But the government likes to just give money out whenever there's a problem and provide solutions. And, of course, it's almost like a huge behavior modification program because it determines what you do around the kitchen table if you're going to buy a car and a house or whatever. It's all based on interest rates, investor psychology, creates asset bubbles, and that sort of thing. So what's been the legacy of the Federal Reserve has been your money. And we have some old folks here who can remember when cars cost maybe $1,000. How many people remember when a car cost $1,000, $2,000? What's happened in 30, 40 years? Look at this chart. Right here, starting in 1945, is when the welfare state began. That's significant right there. So from 1913 all the way down to present day, we've lost almost all the value of our currency. This is really hidden theft. It's hidden because people can't figure it out, because the government gets the benefit of making the money first. Wouldn't you like that idea? Wouldn't you like to be a counterfeiter? And then they force you to accept that money through legal tender laws. Real money, by the way, doesn't need legal tender laws. If you had gold and silver, livestock, or seashells, people would probably accept it. But now we accept money for what it is. There is a need, I feel, a great need to abolish the Fed. I'm not alone on this. Ron Paul has said this, and they said, what would you replace it with? And we'll give you an idea, but we don't really need a central bank. Panama doesn't have a central bank, and they've never had a crisis in Central America. Think of that. But the idea has caught on. The Bible says an unjust weight is an abomination unto God. In other words, it cheats people. He doesn't like cheating, an unjust scale. It encourages legalized plunder by the bankers. The bankers are plundering us. It legitimizes theft and coveting. The Bible says the sixth commandment, that thou shalt not steal. Tenth commandment says thou shalt not covet. You should not, seventh commandment. So basically it almost encourages hidden theft or stealing on a scale never seen in history before. It's producing a national debt, usury debt. It will eventually destroy monetary institutions. Milton Friedman said there's never been a fiat currency that did not eventually fail. It would never pass what they call a supremacy test of the Supreme Court. It's never been brought before the Supreme Court to actually see if it would fit with Article 1, Section 10 of the Constitution, that we should only have gold and silver and not emit bills and so on. It would never pass that test today, and it's never been challenged because they don't want to try it. They know better. Section 30 of the Federal Reserve Act says, yes, we can abolish this, and they should. So they have it within their power, but the politicians don't want to do it because it's become a relationship, right? How are you going to pay for the welfare state? So basically, they need to return all the gold back to the United States and give it back to us. It's our money anyway. It's not the bankers, okay? So basically, what we have here is interesting. This is a Federal Reserve note on the top right up here. And it says Federal Reserve. I know you can't read it. I can't even read it. Federal Reserve note up here. And on the bottom, we have what they call, as a specimen, it's a United States note. A United States note. That's what we should have, is a United States note, not a Federal Reserve note. Because the fiscal agent for the United States should not be a private banking cartel. It should be the people themselves. It should be the U.S. Treasury, just like the Constitution directs. Amen? That is something that they've taken from us, violated. In my book, I frequently call them money changers, okay? And Jesus had a certain opinion about the money changers. He got very angry in the Gospels at the time when they were abusing the people, creating unjust scales, unjust trade for the shekel in the temples. And the love of money is what? The root of all evil. So it's the money changers have been with us all along. Jesus had some pretty hard words for the politicians of his day, you know, the religious leaders, Sanhedrin and so on. So he has an opinion about politicians and bankers and what they're doing to the people, the masses like us. And where did this come from? We have to go back to John Maynard Keynes in the turn of this century, who had a tremendous influence on welfare and status theories about economics. He also believed strongly in a central bank, the need to stimulate the economy. Of course, Karl Marx believed that too in 1843. That's one of the planks, was to have a central bank. It's right there in the Communist Manifesto. It's not exactly the Austrian school of economics. This is one of redistribution of the wealth, and it helped encourage the growth of the welfare state. How did this happen? Here's a key quote. Now, this is from his book in 1920, after World War II, that after the Roaring Twenties, he said, by a continuous process of inflation, governments can confiscate secretly and unobserved an important part of the wealth of their citizens. The process engages all the hidden forces of economic law on the side of destruction and does it in a manner that not one man in a million can understand. You folks who just said you had a car for $1,000, $2,000, now cars are $30,000 and $40,000. Have cars gotten 30 and 40 times better? Not really. What's happened? It's kind of like gold going up. They say, gold's going up. Yeah, you know what it is? Gold isn't getting expensive. The currency's getting cheap. It's chasing more dollars, chasing after the same goods and so on. John Maynard Keynes, also responsible for the post-war period. By the way, World War II was financed, 60% of it, by the Federal Reserve System. Politicians woke up to that fact. That's what the historians have noted, because they realized if they could fund an entire war, for heaven's sakes, we could probably expand, do anything. And so it really opened the door for the welfare state. So at the Bretton Woods Agreement, and this is in my book, very important to know this bit of history, folks. The UN conference in 1944 demonetized the gold backing for 16 world currencies and pegged them to the U.S. dollar, making the dollar the reserve currency of the world, a paper standard, if you will. It also created the World Bank and International Monetary Fund to monitor these things. And again, this was a lender of last resort on a global scale. We're not talking just the United States now. They took the theories and took it all the way to the end. It was John Maynard Keynes' goal in life, actually. He hated gold. He called it the barbaric relic. And he wanted to demonetize all paper and just float. And that's where we are today. We're on a very slippery slope. So what's happened? We have the growth of the bipartisan welfare state. And I like to call it that. You guys are a little bit burned out about politics right now in Des Moines. But it's basically a bipartisan effort. And this is what Voltaire said. He said, the art of government consists of taking as much money as possible from one class of citizen to give to the other. And that's the only thing government's really good at. I mean, I'm going to take from this group in the center here, and I'm going to give it to these people. And, of course, I want to take some from you and give it to this group over here. And maybe they'll vote for me, see? In fact, it was H.L. Mencken who said, government is a broker in pillage, and every election is sort of an advance auction on the stolen goods. I mean, we've had a lot of auctioneers here in Des Moines, Iowa, going through here on the stolen goods that you have. I love that quote. The Cato Institute today calls the Republicans Democrats basically one Republicrat party. And the only difference between a statesman and a politician is a politician looks out for the next election and a statesman looks out for the next generation. And we have one man I know running for that who fits that category, Dr. Ron Paul. He's 71 years old. He's looking out for the next generation. He should be home taking care of his grandchildren. He's out, confronting the media. Well, let's look where we've gotten to, folks. You knew I'd get to this. Here's our national debt, okay? This is, we hit our first $1 trillion in 1980. This was under Reagan's first term. I won't go into this because it's in the book, and it's a little bit dreary to get into trillions of dollars, right? A trillion seconds would take 30,000 years. So in case you can't comprehend that, that's a long time. 20 million people right now work for the government. In 1816, only 4,500 people worked for the government, and 4,000 of them worked for the Postal Department. What has happened? It's a growth industry. Ronald Reagan used to say that there's never been a government agency that's been created that goes out of existence. And this equally has contributed to the broad M3 money supply. And what this means is all the money in circulation around the world, all the U.S. dollars floating everywhere. And do you notice the connection? The national debt's up there, and here's where the M3 money supply is. The money's being printed by the Fed to monetize the debt. And that's a term that can only be used by the Federal Reserve. 70% of our money supply is offshore. Should we be concerned about that, do you think? What might they do if they don't like the dollar anymore? We'll get to that. They suspended this report, by the way. This is the M3 money supply report. It was suspended here. You can't read it. It was suspended in March of 2006 for the very reason that we just went from a budget hike from $8 trillion to $8.9 trillion. And I guess they didn't really want you to know how they were going to afford to do that. You're not supposed to know that. So they suspended the report. So nobody knows. We kind of know what they're up to. In fact, it's running at 14% probably. Now, that's raw inflation, okay? This is not the wholesale price inflation figures that I'm going to show you. This is what the CPI, or the core inflation rate, they call it. The Fed creates monetary inflation, and that creates price inflation. So if there's more money chasing after goods, that's why things are going to go up. And they will. And they will. The core inflation rate excludes food and gasoline, because we really don't care about food and gasoline, right? Nobody uses that anymore. It's not important, I mean, to put in the figures. And they say, well, it moves around too much, so it's not really important to put in there. But the very idea that they exclude it helps them look better, because the core inflation is tremendously more than that. Monday of this week, we had a new budget passed, and it's $3.1 trillion. Now, President Bush said this is a good and sound budget. This is a good and sound budget to go bankrupt at this rate. It's incomprehensible. He has added $3 trillion more of the national debt just in his term alone, just in his term alone. And so we're up to that figure of $9.8 trillion right now. And the components of the national debt are a little complex, but I'm going to help you understand this. There is a difference between, on the left here, we have the interest on the national debt, which in 1975, the total national debt was $430 billion. That's what it is today. The public debt is opposed to the publicly held debt. The public debt is really the national debt, and then publicly held debt is all public U.S. securities held by insurance companies and private brokerage firms, and maybe in your portfolios out there today, I suspect. So that's publicly held. We also have 58% of the national debt is public, and 42% is federal, and the component of that is it includes the intergovernment debt, they call it. This is the Social Security, Medicare, and the Civil Service Trust Funds. These are trust funds. These are trust funds that are supposed to be held in trust by the government, that they'll be there for you when you retire. What's happened here is they've treated it both as an asset and a liability. This figure up here in the blue, this blue section, is the unfunded liabilities that the government has right now. And it's roughly about $75, $80 trillion. That's a big amount. The bondholders offshore hold considerable amount, and they consider this money to be both an asset and a liability, okay? How many baby boomers we have here tonight? Looks like quite a few. Okay, I'm one of them. And in 1937, Franklin Roosevelt came up with the Social Security system. Now, we were all suffering in 1935, and it was good to take care of the old, the people of old age and so on. In fact, that's what it was called, Old Age and Now Survivors Disability Insurance, or OASDI. They've added this on as they've gone along. Now, if you're disabled, now if you're a survivor, you get some of the Social Security money. It's been paid in. Of course, it's really not being held in trust. It's just being paid out as soon as it comes in. That's called what? A Ponzi scheme, right? So Social Security, there's 80 million of us now. The demographics were when Franklin Roosevelt started, it was 42 workers for every retiree. It's about 2-to-1 right now. So you can see this cannot be sustained very well. This is also what they call the third rail of politics. Do you know what that means? If you touch the electrical rail in a railroad track, electric rail, it will kill you. And if you're a politician and if you dare to touch it, that issue, you're going to get in trouble. It'll cost you your career. The unfunded liabilities is mostly in the healthcare sector, as this chart would reveal on the right. And, of course, it's in red. It's 5 times larger, the unfunded liabilities, right now. This report by Paul O'Neill, this gentleman here was the U.S. Treasury Secretary under Bush's first term. And he issued a report in the foreign press, that's where I found it, noting, they call it the Gockhill-Smithers report, that we had unfunded liabilities of $45 trillion. It's now higher. And that was immediately pulled. In fact, he was fired for that. He was fired shortly after for revealing that, and that cost him his career. This gentleman, however, he is still working for the government, and this is David Walker. How many have heard of David Walker? Some of you have. This gentleman is the comptroller of the Government Accounting Office, and he says, without meaningful reform, The long-term financial outlook for Medicare is bleak. The growth in Medicare spending will become increasingly unsustainable. We're on an unsustainable path. We have non-negotiable government bonds in the trust funds that are non-negotiable and have to be paid by future generations that are not born or hardly working now. The demographics will not support this. And so there's only one, again, the government can only tax, borrow, or print money, right? So it's kind of stuck in a hard place here. And the first baby boomer just retired 5 weeks ago on January 1st. If they were 1946, this is their year to retire. And this is pretty much like Enron's bookkeeping. Okay, you're not supposed to know this. You're just to think that everything's there and it'll be paid for. There was a book that inspired me back a few years ago. When I was reading this on an offshore seminar, I was on an airplane. I thought I'll have time to read a book. This book, even the subtitle would get your attention. What you need to know about America's economic future. And it's talking about the coming generational storm. This has to do with the unfunded liabilities. This is a Boston economist, Lawrence Kotlikoff, who is noting the fact that we're going to have to get into privatizing medical care, rationing of care. We're going to have to come to some hard solutions for 80 million baby boomers right now. There's about 40 million retired right now. Add 80 more, and you see the problem. The meaningful reforms that are suggested are actually being opposed by ARP, founded in 1958. And you can see a generational or a class warfare developing in which people say that, you can touch someone else's programs but not mine, or, where I've paid in it. And everybody, we have a right because you paid into it, but the government cannot be trusted in a fiduciary role. It's stealing it, okay? It's creating a Ponzi scheme. I don't know where this is going to end up, but it doesn't look very good, and there could be some very bad downside when it comes to euthanasia, mercy killing, rationing life almost. The ethical problems are staggering and, of course, repeated around the world. I think Nazi Germany was a good example. Matthew 10:21 says there'll come a day when young children will rise up and put their parents to death. That's repeated 3 times in the gospel. I'm not sure what that means, but it looks like a tough time coming. The authors say we're heading into one god-awful fiscal storm, and I'm afraid that's part of the component of what we're dealing with. But it doesn't stop there. Everybody here tonight is aware of the subprime crisis we have in America. Here was another asset bubble created by the Federal Reserve. Never gets the blame. Of course, there was a lot of greed to go around, but the subprime crisis is now upon us. Countrywide, Citicorp, J.P. Morgan, write-downs. A lot of risk out there. And from 1950 to 2000, household mortgage debt was about $4.9 trillion. Right now, from 2000 to 2007, we've added $4.8 trillion of new debt. It took 50 years to do what we did in 7. Through 16 interest rate reductions by Alan Greenspan, we took it down to almost 0%. And it created easy money for everybody. Helicopter Ben was throwing money all over. And everybody said, good times are here. And the mortgage companies got caught up in it. And they had to produce more or they'd lose their job, and they were looking the other way as far as the appraisals, and everybody just had a great time. See, there's only two emotions in the marketplace, fear and greed. Or as Warren Buffett says, when people get fearful, I get greedy. And when they get greedy, I get fearful. And the reason he gets greedy when they're fearful is because he buys undervalued companies that they're offloading, and then he makes a lot of money. That's why he's a billionaire. But, there is a pattern to this. And what we're seeing, by the way, 38% of this debt, this mortgage debt, is held offshore. They've securitized the debt and held it or held offshore by foreign countries. Do you think they're very happy with our subprime packages that we're selling them? So we have a housing crisis. Got a little bit enthusiastic here all over the country. We have some hard areas, Arizona, where I'm from, California, Florida, and, of course, other places in the country right now. They're trying to come to our aid. They bail out, and when they do bail out people, they're merely postponing the reckoning day. I mean, that's all I can tell you. That's all we're really doing. The Fed, and it encourages moral hazard because it's like you can make these accidents, and then you have to pay for the consequences. The government's going to come to your rescue like they did in a House vote of 380 to 34. It passed $168 billion of your money that the Fed's going to make. In an economic aid plan. Isn't that nice that the politicians can come to our aid anytime we need? Is that the role of the politician? That scares me, the very notion of it. 46% of all loans are adjustable rates that were reset in 2008. That's a pretty big amount. And these were not, these were not encouraged. In the old days, you had to put 10% down 30 years and so on. So they came up with a lot of creative ideas. If you want to make a note of it, there's a gal I know who trades in mortgage brokering. If you like refinancing of anything like that, just ask me later. But there's some things that people can do, places to look for, Christian people counseling and helping you work these things out. Okay? The monthly mortgage resets. Here's what we're looking at here, people. This green area up here on the chart indicates the amount of resets that are going to happen in the next year, 2008. We've just had $400 billion of problem, and now we're going into the storm of $500 billion, okay? And then that's not even counting the equity strippers, people who have decided to strip their homes of their equity, and they have now more debt, and they can't pay it, and so on. What's happening is there's a lot of home foreclosures. Maybe not here so bad, but actually here in Polk County, it was just announced that their revenues depend on taxes and being up where they were based on the house values when they were nice and high. Now that they're falling, they're going to keep those tax rates up. And this is happening all over the country right now, that house values have contracted, but the tax revenues have not. And what you have is a major problem of loan delinquencies that are now coming, because people can't make their home and their car payments. And that's what this chart indicates, the growth of that in these quarters. What does the Bible say? The borrower is the slave to the lender. You get into this situation, you're going to pay a price. And it's always the bankers who win. It's always the money changers. They're always with us. We have another problem. A lot of people are not familiar with the term or perhaps even what they are. I don't think the people who buy and sell them, even trade in them, know what derivatives are. These are credit derivatives. And this left chart shows pretty much since 1990, in just a period of 17 years, we've grown an aggregate, a notional amount of $415 trillion. Now, that's a lot of seconds. That's a huge amount of money. We now have 8,000 hedge funds advancing these, and 80% of these are credit derivatives, and that is to say they're held by the banks in the credit market, the credit meltdown that we're seeing right now. And this is something that could happen easily. Just one accident out there, just one counterparty risk on both ends could unravel the whole thing. Warren Buffett calls it weapons of mass financial destruction. So these are five of the biggest banks who have exposure, if you want to make a note of it, and you can read that. But there's 968 U.S. banks, including the top five banks involved in this activity. The top five banks, just the top five, have 98%. Of the risk, 1.5% to the rest. Look at that. This is the money center banks I'm talking about that have the privilege of dealing as a member of the Federal Reserve System. They're too big to fail. And that means too big to fail means it's too big to let them go down and they'll have a bailout. And that's kind of what we're doing. You know, we're doing that with them. The brokerage firms are also in trouble. Bear Stearns has lost 53% of its market cap in just 10 months. Merrill Lynch had write-downs. Most of them fired their CEOs. Everybody got caught up in greed, you know, and this is really what we're seeing. It's being played out right now. And so we're just seeing the outcome of that. The U.S. dollar index today is 76 points. That means it's trade-weighted exchange against other currencies, and it's really just a perception of how it's doing out there. It's pretty low. If it gets to 70, some say 60 or 55, I would say it's going to go critical. I would say that even China and other countries might have to start pegging their money to the euro or something else. So in the foreign press, the London Business Magazine has set it all on the cover. The dollar no longer dominates in the marketplace. And we're going to develop that theme, which I do in my book tonight as well. In fact, we have to go back right now to the national debt in the United States to 1970. That's where this chart is in my book. 1970 is off to the left here, and we started out with the welfare and warfare years of the 1960s, the Vietnam era, and so on. We had the twin deficits that started to grow at that very time, at that very moment. That's when we started getting the national debt and trade deficits, exporting our inflation, which we did. The U.S. started to import crude oil from OPEC at that same time in that year. Most people, when the embargo came, didn't even realize that we were importing oil. They thought, we make all of our own, you know. China used to produce all of their oil until 1993, and now they import 40%. They're getting pretty thirsty for oil, wouldn't you agree? We're exporting our inflation, and you need to understand how that really works. We're exporting it in the sense that we have a trade deficit, and we can recycle in world markets. We'll look at that in a minute. Closing the gold window in 1971, August 15th, was the most important thing that ever happened in the United States. I'll tell you why. Foreigners had $36 billion of U.S. dollars against $18 billion in the gold. Remember the gold at the Federal Reserve? And they didn't have enough to redeem because the Bretton-Woods Agreement said that if you have foreign dollars, we will redeem them for gold. That's why it was a paper gold standard. It really wasn't backed that well. The gold exchange standard, he suspended that or decoupled the gold standard. And he said, in fact, in that same year, they became a Keynesian. Now he's a Keynesian. He realized that it was a good thing to have a central bank to do this. So he created a floating exchange rate, and from that point on, the U.S. has technically been bankrupt or broke, some economists have noted. We are basically, again, we're postponing. We're now in borrowed time. And this is all goes back to the Bretton-Woods Agreement and to our good friend, Mr. John Maynard Keynes. A total collapse of the Bretton-Woods Agreement was not really envisioned by the founders. They never would have dreamed that that could happen. He called it a barbaric relic, and now he succeeded worldwide. There is no gold-backed currency in the world today. It's all floating fiat currencies, and we're all in uncharted waters right now. This is documented in this book I've used in my research here as well. Following this event, the Smithsonian Institute, 10 nations arrived there, and they had an emergency meeting to come up with an idea of trading in a narrow currency band, they called it, to help smooth things over a bit, because they didn't quite know where to go with this. In 1960, OPEC was formed as a wealthy cartel, and again, their first embargo was in 1973. What happened there was they raised the crude oil prices from $3 to $12. That was a 400% increase. That 400% increase started making them pretty rich. And they had a lot of dollars, excess dollars, offshore. There was a plan devised in the summer of 1973. It's in my report. This report, by the way, I recommend you get, in which they decided to come up with a plan to recycle those dollars offshore. And what they did, after the 400% increase, the U.S. dollars were being converted to petrodollars. Any dollar that's offshore and being used to buy crude oil becomes a petrodollar because it was used to buy petrol. And it's held by the OPEC nations. The U.S. Saudi Commission was created, and it created a strict U.S. dollar peg in June 8th of 1974. And this is very important to understand, because at this time is when they pegged all crude oil contracts on world markets to the U.S. dollar. There was no other currency in which you could buy. That's changing today, and we're going to see that. And then in turn, they invest back in our capital markets, and it helps us make us look pretty good. All right? There are three basic trade oil markers. There's two exchanges which trade on the crude oil markets right now today in New York and London. This is the London-New York financial districts, which are really controlling the supporting the dollar in the world. This was set up in 1973 by the Saudi Arabian Monetary Authority. That's basically their central bank in Saudi Arabia. David Mulford, a London banker, was sent over there to make sure that all the money that they had in these oil-rich countries came back to the New York and London banks to make sure their good friends had their money. In return, we provide defense contracts or a protection racket, as some call it, a syndicate to protect the Persian Gulf and the Saud royal family and the royal families that are over there, Kuwait included, and so on. This also is when the G7 was formed, which is meeting today in London, by the way, and it was formed for the purpose of monitoring a new macroeconomic model. And I made this chart up, and I wish you could see it a little bit better. It will be on the DVD later. And this basically demonstrates the trade deficits that the U.S. has up here. Our exchange, the foreigners exchange their exports for our U.S. dollars. The U.S., they then, foreigners hold the U.S. dollars for repayment and purchases. And these are uniquely called euro dollars because they're offshore. They got that term. They are then used to buy oil contracts in exchange for crude oil on the markets, and those go to the OPEC nations, and these are petrodollars accumulated principally and directed by the House of Saud back to the United States as foreign direct investment into our countries. And right now, 50% of our trade deficit is for crude oil contracts. If it was $80 billion last month, that meant $40 billion went to the OPEC nations. And annually, that's staggering. It's almost $400 billion. So they're taking in a lot of money. The foreign nations must buy oil contracts in U.S. dollars. This is beginning to change, however, and also the U.S. dollars are repatriated and they prop up our markets. So you wonder, as you look at stocks, markets, and things going up, America seems to look pretty good, but it's because U.S. dollars have nowhere else to go, so they come back into our own markets, right? So at the gas pump, at least half of the profits up here are crude oil nations making those. We put a little tax in there and so on, and in the European Union, Netherlands is paying almost $8 a gallon, Italy $5 a gallon, so on. That's not because they import more, it's just because they have a welfare state and put more taxes on to everything. So, but we're probably going to get to that place and so on. This chart demonstrates the foreign direct investment. It's running about $11 trillion right now. That's, again, a pretty hefty amount because, again, they don't have anywhere else to go with their money. You could argue that we're the safest market in the world, but, you know, we have some vulnerabilities here. And the euro challenge is what is really, really underway right now. There is a new transactional currency that's underway since 2002, and this is allowing countries to make a choice. They're starting to, the macroeconomic model of the petrodollar exchange system here is breaking down. The euro currency is challenging U.S. dollar imperialism. The petrodollar exchange system is breaking down, and the U.S. is determined to stop such a thing developing. You can imagine what would happen if 70% of your money supply was no longer needed very much around the world. So I did write this report that goes into this. I encourage you to get it tonight and look this over. And I want to ask, how many military people do we have here tonight? Veterans, okay. Maybe people, maybe some of your family and friends are serving in Iraq. There was as we got into the Iraq war, the problem with Saddam Hussein was because in November of 2000, he dared to use his UN food program of $10 billion in reserves and started taking or accepting it in euros, switching it to euros, which they did through the Piraeus Bank in Paris. He started to take in oil contracts in euro denominated, and he's a member of OPEC, remember, 12th member of OPEC. And he started to challenge the petrodollar standard exchange system. Again, the model that had been put in place since 1974 was finally being challenged, and this is what is happening today. He was labeled as the Axis of Evil in 2001. Paul O'Neill, the gentleman who got fired for blowing the whistle on unfunded liabilities, was also in the first cabinet meeting with President Bush and his staff when he learned that there was the first thing they wanted to do in his book and in his 60-minute report was to find a way to get Saddam Hussein. And he was trying to address fiscal issues, and they were concerned with geopolitical issues, and we got to go get Saddam Hussein. Something had to happen. This seemed to be the agenda fully 8 months before 9/11, and I discussed some of this in this report. And this became suddenly a neoconservative foreign policy. That is to say, we started to build a case pretty strong that we needed to go after Saddam. And they had something we had to go get. And there was weapons of mass destruction and so on. And nothing was ever really found. Now, Saddam is a bad person. There's a lot of monsters out there to go after. But it really wasn't the source of terrorism that we thought. In fact, it was actually I'd say Pakistan and Saudi Arabia are actually more threats to us than these countries. And we developed a rather hawkish foreign policy, interventionist policy, as maybe Ron Paul might put it, to go after other nations, regime change, and so on. Now, I just developed this for the purpose because we know that there was a lot of oil over there to go beginning. And you can be rather cynical, as I said on the radio this morning, that it probably was about oil. And we know that to be the case. So we went in with Shock and Awe on February 5th, 2003, and this the USS Abraham is where they met President Bush on a Lockheed jet, and they said, mission accomplished. They had the banner out and so on. You might be asking, was the mission accomplished that fast? The mission was really accomplished when the UN was allowed to convert their oil contracts back to the U.S. dollar away from the euro on those markets. And they stopped, in other words, an OPEC member from invoicing or challenging for the first time a petro-euro peg and not a petrodollar peg. And this is very important to understand. All right? This was even though the euro was up 30%. I mean, that's just not even good sense business-wise. Alan Greenspan's just written a book, The Age of Turbulence. He says it's about oil. Iraq was about oil. They own 12% of the oil in the world. See? He's a Fed chairman for 14 years. He's a chairman on the board of governor or the board of J.P. Morgan Chase. He knows pretty darn well that it's probably about the dollar, how vulnerable the dollar was. In fact, I would say that there's really two twin pillars of U.S. strength today. And you need to understand The first pillar is the dollar pillar. It's the notion that the dollar is the reserve currency of the world, the transactional currency of the world. The other pillar, of course, is the military pillar, which helps to support this, helps to underwrite this. The military pillar supports the dollar pillar, and the dollar pillar supports the military pillar. Now, what do you think is the most vulnerable pillar? Nobody's going to take on our military. The most vulnerable is the U.S. dollar itself, maintaining it as a reserve currency of the world. This, I would say to you, we are in a currency war right now. We're going to be in a currency war, and I can see this developing right now. President Eisenhower said in 1961, he cautioned against an industrial military complex developing in such a way that it would misplace power, would be invested in the defense contracts or industry here in the United States. This is basically where we've come up today with the defense budget is $644 billion, which is 42 larger than the next 42 nations combined. We are all over the United States, or all over the world, 800 bases in 65 countries. Ron Paul has talked about this policy as well. And this is a very large mission that America has to maintain its presence around the world. We are preempting. This is our U.S. military imperialism, and we are policing the world. And there's a comment made by this gentleman here in his book, The Century of War, and he says, the U.S., since August 1971, when we went off the gold standard with the IMF, he says, the dollar is no longer backed by gold. Instead, it's backed by F-16s and Abrams battle tanks defending liberty in the U.S. dollar around the world. And I don't think that really should be our foreign policy. John Quincy Adams says that America doesn't go abroad in search of monsters to destroy. We need a humble foreign policy in the sense that it's regulated by our genuine interest and so on. The Middle East and Near East foreign policy is a good example of this, in which in 1998, the Central Asian gas pipeline was right here, through here, runs through Afghanistan. And I'm just the messenger that's trying to get the facts together on these kind of things. But you had a situation in which in the post-9/11 period, we met immediately after Afghanistan, the intelligence communities were a little bit confused why we were doing this. The Taliban, as it turns out, were blocking the sent gas program from Chevron and so on, and they were blocking it through Afghanistan. And finally, we went in 4 weeks after 9/11, and we changed the regime there, got rid of the Taliban, and we installed Hamid Karzai, who was actually a consultant employee of Chevron as well. So in the world of big oil or intrigue or money, you have to really connect the dots. And I've tried to do that in this report and other books and to show the threat, that how important it is to secure not only oil, but the supremacy of the U.S. dollar on oil contracts. Brzezinski has written a book called The Grand Chessboard, and he likes to talk about these kind of strategies. Of course, he's comes out of the Trilateral Commission and so on. What we have developing today is Americans' foreign policy is creating a lot of enemies, around the world, and particularly Russia and China, as seen here. There's a new Warsaw Pact that's been formed called the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. This is the Warsaw Pact of the NATO of the Far East. It was formed in 1996, and it now includes full members, including Russia, China, the Central Asian countries, and, of course, the rogue state of Iran, as well as Venezuela and these kind of people. These are not exactly friends of the United States or our foreign policy. This is where the territory in which they cover in Central Asia, and you can see Iran is right here and so on, and that's a pretty large region. America, is, again, our presence is over there. And there's a new book written by John Cooley in which he called Currency Wars, in which they're trying to commit economic warfare against the United States because they know our dollar pillar is our weakest link, and they know that they can kick that out. Now, that's a strategy that's clearly being pursued by these adversaries and rogue states to do that. We were threatening a 27% tariff on China just about 2 months ago, the House Democrats were, and this would have put a tariff, this would have been Vice President of Chairman of China said that he would dump our dollars. He would start dumping our $1.3 trillion in currency reserves. This would be a tremendous blow to the economy. And, of course, we see Russia is involved in this alliance with China and, of course, our friend Ahmadinejad over there in Iran. William Hawkins, a businessman, says the massive American trade deficit with China gives Beijing the hard currency needed for weapons acquisitions, mostly Russian, designed to attack American targets. And I think this is what's happening. V.I. Lenin once said that we would sell enough rope to our enemies to do what? Hang ourselves. And this is the policy. It's just all the monetary. Someone said, follow the money trail, follow the power. So we're basically on a slippery slope with these rogue states, adversaries, and superpowers. They don't want a unipolar world, the U.S. run. They say they want a multipolar world. And Iran is a member. They're the fourth largest exporter of oil in the world. They are also threatening to switch to the euro. In fact, they halted all dollar transactions for their oil just about 1 or 2 months ago. So we're basically, I guess you could say, we're entering into yet a second currency war. I think Iraq was the first one, and I think the member of OPEC, Iran, is certainly in their trajectory right now. The euro is rising in power. This is the European Union. Of course, these gentlemen here are smiling because the euro is ascending as a new transactional currency to challenge the U.S. dollar supremacy. This bank is in Frankfurt, Germany. If you don't know this man, his name is Jean-Claude Trinchet. He will be the most powerful man in the world, just like they used to introduce Alan Greenspan as the Federal Reserve Chairman. We're in a period in which the Federal Reserve replaced the British pound sterling in 1944-45, and the euro is on track to exchange or replace the U.S. dollar as the next reserve currency in the world. And Europe is smiling about this because they know they're going to inherit a tremendous superpower in this region of the world. And I think this fits into a prophetic perspective as well. 27 members right now. Their largest trading partner is China, and China's largest trading partner is them. So it's really not the U.S. It's really China and Europe that are getting along the most right now, okay? So again, I want to encourage you to get this special report that I've written. It's all in here, and it goes into much detail. And I have 45 footnotes, websites, and so on. I like to do good research. Challenge me on that, not just, you know, how you feel it should be or something, because I think the facts speak for itself. This will be deal with Iran, China, Russia, and, of course, the new American currency, which I think is coming at us pretty strong. Let's keep moving and look at the perfect financial storm that I write about in my book. This is a new book by Patrick Buchanan. A lot of my clients have read this book. I think the theme, reckoning, must be catching on with people. So Pat Buchanan probably wanted to use America's Financial Reckoning Day and said this Chuck Coppice guy took that title, so I'm going to have to make up a new title. Here we have him talking about unsustainable liabilities, public and private bankruptcy, domestic asset bubbles, subprime credit collapse, U.S. currency depreciation, securities downgrade, geopolitical confrontations, and global economic warfare. These are all the things we're facing right now. This is a perfect financial storm, not something we're going to deal with very well. The U.S., Europe is rising in power, and this is what T.R. Reid says in his book, The United States of Europe. The success of Europe's common currency could bring America's financial house of cards tumbling down. And I think we're on a slippery slope here because this has happened in history. And if you get something like that happening, you're talking about a hyperinflationary depression. And this goes back to Germany, but 70% of our broad money supply is offshore. $3 trillion are in U.S. bonds right now. There is no negative feedback loop for a hyperinflationary cycle. When all the dollars around the world come floating back to the United States in such a way, there's no negative feedback loop in the monetary science, as they call that. It's just going to be a breakdown, and it could be a breakdown of the social contract as well. 1923, Germany went through this. This isn't an Argentina-style crisis. This is Argentina with something else. German hyperinflation in 1923 was because they had too many marks around the world. And Jens Parson in his book says the international reputation of the Reichsmark, the faith that an economic giant like Germany could not fail, made this possible. They were very arrogant. And America is pretty much in that same position right now, okay? So let's have a summary real quick of part one. And that is this. The U.S. central bank policies are creating a perfect financial storm right now in the United States. We're on a slippery slope with the U.S. economy in grave danger of a German-style contagion. This could happen in the Forex markets quickly. It took a year to grind Germany to nothing. Today in Forex markets, it's 24/7. These things can melt down very fast. It doesn't take long to do that. The loss of U.S. reserve currency and leadership in the world, I think, is a distinct possibility. And again, I'm just the messenger on this. I'm just, you know, trying to put the facts together. My degree's in theology, not in economics, but I think I can figure it out. We want to talk tonight real quick about investing wisely in an uncertain world. We have registry cards. I hope you have filled these out. We want to collect these here in a moment. Please, if these are filled out right now, I'd like to collect these for our special drawing during the break, and we're going to go into a break here in a moment. And the ushers will come down in the middle here. Just put them into the middle. Please fill these out, one per household, and I will be speaking with you later, sign you a book, got some other gifts for you, got a nice coin for you. You'll have to see what that is, okay? Investing wisely in an uncertain world is Patrick Henry said, for my part, whatever anguish, I'm willing to know the whole truth and then provide for it. And how many Boy Scouts we have here tonight? We like to be prepared. The Boy Scout motto is be prepared. And so that's what we need to do. You must be a contrarian. And there is a need for financial diversification. The principle in the Bible is divide your portion into seven or eight, for you don't know what misfortune may occur. As a regulatory disclaimer, I have to say that I'm not soliciting buying or selling securities, and you're required to consult your own legal and tax experts in that area. I'm not licensed in that area. I used to be. And now I head up IDP Consulting Group. It stands for Investors Diversified Portfolio. And I like to talk about an investment triangle, which I illustrate in my book. There's 30 pages in the book that goes into this in the end. I think the price of the book is probably worth that chapter alone. At the bottom of this triangle, we have a core position in precious metals. We have also cash and savings and growth and income. And these are three areas that are fairly well balanced out. You need a core position in precious metals. I don't care if we get it through. I can help broker that. I'm not here for that reason. But that's something you need to do as a core position in your assets. And it varies on your need, risk tolerance, and so on. But I would say 30, 50%. I have some clients that are practically 85, 90%, in fact. Of course, some people become millionaires in doing that lately. We only have, if you took all the gold in the world, it would make about a 60-foot square cube, 145 metric tons. It would fit in this building right here tonight. All the gold ever mined in history, 145 metric tons, would fit right in this room. And that's why they call it a precious metal, right? There's only about $1.7 trillion in gold above ground. There's about $120 trillion in paper assets. So I guess you could do the math and say that when people decide to buy gold pretty soon, it could probably go into the thousands of dollars, which I think it very well be. The gold supply and demand ratios are up pretty well as well. And India, the Arabs are buying 67% more. India's 47%, China's 53%, and so on. You know, Gresham's law says that bad money drives out good money. Bad Federal Reserve notes drive out good money, gold, and people start hoarding it. This is what they did in the Great Depression and created a tremendous contraction. In fact, it even prolonged the Great Depression because people were scared to spend and so on. The gold production in South Africa is down, but the gold price is being suppressed because central banks who own the gold are dumping it on the market, and they're causing it to regulate the price of gold. So gold should be a lot higher than it is, and someday that's not going to last much longer. You can also get into Sterling Trust accounts, and this is what I deal with a lot. You can convert qualified plans, IRA accounts, into a precious metals IRA for safekeeping. It's a nominal fee for this. It's segregated by serial number. You got a COMEX-approved depository, and you're not in paper assets, and you're protecting your nest egg, which is your retirement funds, okay? That's good stewardship, because gold and silver is biblical money. It's constitutional money, and that's what we should have. We're going to walk on streets of gold, right? Not paper. Tangible assets and real estate. You can get into diamonds, gemstones. There's a list here, rare coins, paintings, jewelry, collectibles, antiques, silver sets, oriental rugs, and real estate. I would recommend don't get into real estate. Don't get into real estate. You can get into it when it's really bottom. If you want a bargain, you could probably be like Warren Buffett and buy on the bottom, okay? Everybody wants to know about cash and savings. What do? I would avoid all double E and double H bonds. This is all in my book, by the way. I would also, because that's a bond instrument, you can also get a rating on your bank. You need to find out if your bank's in good shape or not, and you can get an independent analysis made of your institution. Stay out of those five banks, I would recommend. Vanguard, T-bill money market accounts, those are pretty good, 3.7%. That's a T-bill account, short term. It's not backed by the commercial paper that you don't know what's in there. It's probably all a bunch of subprime stuff, and they're selling to China. Merck hard currency fund, 16.8% return. These are hard currency funds. You can look up some of these symbols. Again, these are all in my book. You can actually start hedging against the dollar indexes and get into reverse indexes or hedge funds that actually, when the dollar goes down, you actually make some money. So, and then even offshore, and there's nothing wrong with banking offshore. It's perfectly legal. And there are some recommendations that I like that you can do for that. That certainly is a leg up on privacy, and you'd probably be in the euro currency and making 10% a year just on the currency appreciation. So that's a good thing to do. You can actually get foreign currency, which some people do in the euro currency, and they like to do that. EverBank Foreign Savings and CDs is one of my favorite. EverBank.com, if you want to write that down. The only bank in the United States out of Florida that denominates in foreign currencies for $2,500 minimum deposit. They have CDs for $10,000 and $20,000. And I've got clients making 14% plus 14% currency appreciation on an FDIC 90-day CD, 24%. Where can you get that in your bank? There are opportunities out there, and they're not all in the U.S., and you can look elsewhere. If you have questions on that, ask me later or ask my friend back in the end back here. Growth and income considerations real quick. I'd be shorting the U.S. equity markets. They're very risky right now. Looking at the commodity sectors, this is a no-brainer. You can get into natural resources, energy, oil, grain complex. Wheat's up 92%. Grains are up 22%. 54% of all the corn grown in the world is in the United States and probably in this state right here, Iowa. And ethanol. I mean, we have a growth industry for these kind of things. The Rogers Raw Materials Fund is one of my favorite, RJA, and deals in grains. iShares Silver Trust, you can actually get into silver. There's 10 ounces per share, and you actually got title to the silver. And it's a good way to do that without having the bulk or storage of metals and that sort of thing. That's in my book as well. Unhedged mining share funds, that means you get into the ones that don't fix the price in. Let's let the price go up to $3,000 and you'll make more per share and so on. You can also get into some of the big ones. Newmont's the biggest gold mining company in the world, and I have a lot of that stock in Freeport, McMoRan and stuff. Oil is not going to go down. Gold and silver is not going to go down. We're really looking at a boom in these markets. You can get into some reverse and index funds, talk about that in a minute, and we have something back on the table there. These gas prices might be something you'll be looking at here pretty soon. And energy's not going down. It's not going to be cheap anytime soon. Energy costs are only climbing. Every time there's a dip, I would be buying on these dips, and that's what I'm doing these days. U.S. imports, again, 70% of its oil is going to keep doing this. The world needs a lot more, and we'll talk about that in the next section. Part two, inverse exchange trade funds. I have a list of 50 down here that you can short the Dow, the S&P, and others. And when it goes down, look at this. If the Dow goes down, you are going to make money going up. But you have to keep your eye on these things and be careful. But it is a way to hedge the markets, the volatility in the markets. Right now, investing in foreign markets would be the BRIC, they call it. That's Brazil, Russia, and India, and China. These are your growth in countries and that are emerging markets and so on. Franklin Templeton has a great fund that deals with the BRICs that are making pretty good money in that regard. The U.S. is not a very strong place to be putting your money, in my opinion. So you need to be looking and following smart money, George Soros, Bill Gates, Warren Buffett, and so on. Foreign markets, equities, I'd go into the same commodity complexes and so on. Foreign bonds and securities, currency appreciation always attends that, so you're always making 5 or 10% in the mix. So that's just the way it's going to be as we deal with these floating currencies in the world today. Okay? There's a copy of these funds back at the table. If you have any questions, just ask us back there as well. And I would, the Boy Scout in me wants to always be prepared. Even if it's the worst knowledge, I want to know it and prepare for it, as Patrick Henry said. And that might even include a contingency plan on the basics that you may need, food reserves and things like this. Something happens, an accident in the world, terrorism, something, it could shut markets down and it could be a tough time. The Walmart stores may not be open very much. Okay, IDP Consulting Group is my company. Please note the website, pick up my card here if you'd like. And there's a checklist at the table that we encourage you to get. Most of you have tonight. It includes 20 things that you could be or should be doing. And if you have any questions on that, please ask us. And as for me, I'll be out skiing, but you can call me in a couple more weeks. And right now I'm running out of time. So we're going to take a quick 15-minute break. We're just a little bit over. And you can get my book. Most of you have. It's $30. If you get it with this report and the CD, it'll be $35 even. And there's no tax on that. In addition to that, you can make the checks out to IDP Consulting Group. And, of course, we will accept cash. In God we trust, all others pay cash. And finally, there will be a book signing. If you catch me, I might pull out my pen, but maybe after part two we can do some of that. And if you catch me in between, I guess we can do that too. So anyway, thank you for your patience, and we'll continue in part two in about 15 minutes. Have a break. Thank you very much.